Okay. Good evening, everybody. Tonight is February 17th, 2024. And tonight is the 13th lecture in, I guess, starting with the French Revolution. And we've been really focusing on, lately, the reform movement that was really born, that was able to develop because of the French Revolution. Just maybe a little bit as a, just where we're up to. Tonight I'd like to talk about Avram Geiger, another main character, person, leader in the reform movement. But I'd like to just maybe just if we just go back as a little bit how we got here. So we started with a person by the name of Israel Jacobson, and he was himself. He felt that he wanted to modernize the religion. He wanted to bring in people that were not as affiliated. He wanted the Judaism to be like a sister religion to Christianity. And he had his own temple in Sisson. And in Sisson he made various reforms. But again, it was really his own temple. It was, you know, it was a small little place. It wasn't national, so to speak, or anywhere beyond that. I mean, at the time you had many maskilim, many people who were like-minded that were involved in the secular world around them, and they may have felt similarly in the same way to Isaac Jacobson. And then kingdom. Okay, I'm missing it. Okay, just, I guess he was late at night. The kingdom, then when the French Revolution, when Napoleon conquered France, he carved out of the German Empire, he carved out a kingdom called Westphalia. And Westphalia was run by, the king was his brother Jerome, Bonaparte. And Jerome Bonaparte made a consistory of religions just like they did in France itself. And the leader of the consistory was Jacobson. And Jacobson, he used that to force his ideas on all of the Jews that were in the kingdom. This only lasted a few years. I don't think it lasted 10 years, probably more like 6 to 8 years. He had his consistory force his ideas in their shuls, in the synagogues, and then Napoleon lost the war, which means no more Kingdom of Westphalia, and everything went back to the way it was. Isaac Jacobson then moved to Berlin, and he opened in his house the same type of synagogue that he had in Sisson, where this all was. And it started in his house. It started small, but he was picking up a nice crowd. They moved it to a bigger location. But again, it wasn't an official shul. It was in somebody's house. And in Berlin, he was having trouble with the Prussian leader who was not into any change. Okay, and in Berlin, he hired a preacher by the name of Edward Clay. Edward Clay was one of the speakers in Jacobson's synagogue or temple. And then he moved while there were issues with the government about having temple services. He moved to Hamburg, and in Hamburg he started opening up a school. And once he finished with the school, he was running a class. He was running a class for adults as well, and a service, and it started to pick up. And here they decided to make themselves a temple. This is the Hamburg Temple. And this Hamburg temple was different in that it was a real shul. It was a real shul. It means a real building. People bought into it. And it was a real, it was the first time, it was the first like real building built as a Reform shul. In this Reform shul, a number of years later, they made a prayer book. In other words, they made changes in the book, in the Siddur, to reflect their ideas. And it was met with a lot of resistance, controversy about controversy and among the Frum. At the time in Hamburg, there was a Besen, there wasn't a rabbi, and this Besen sent letters to all of the Jewish world, the Frum world, and it was responded by Rabbi Akiva Eger and Sam Sofer and the leaders of the Jews back then. They sent their responses against. It was made into a book, a sefer, and that's the way it was. For the next, after as well, then a number of things happened after that. One is that Hamburg decided, the community of Hamburg decided, let's hire somebody for the religious, that we can have somebody that could relate to people that were not as religious. And that's what they did. They hired a person by the name of Isaac Bernays, who was an Orthodox rabbi. He mainly was there to take over the shul, to take over the school, which he made it, the cheder there, he made into a excellent, excellent school, both in Jewish studies and secular studies. He also was a speaker. He would speak every week in shul, in German, in the German clerical robes that the priests did. And basically for the next 20 years, this was all happening in the 20s, 1820s, but for the next 20 years, it was like sort of an impasse. And besides the fact that Isaac Bernays and the shul was picking, the Orthodox shul was picking up people, or they weren't losing people because of Isaac Bernays, but also in Germany itself, there was like anti-Semitic riots and things going on, and therefore the Reform movement didn't get a foothold. We ended last week by about in the 1840s, the Hamburg Synagogue put out another Siddur, a revised Siddur. Isaac Bernays felt he was hired really not to criticize the non-religion, the non-religious, which he did not do. He kept his bargain, and he was busy working on the school and speaking, and he was doing a great job, keeping, everything balanced.
Status quo.
Status quo, thank you. And then basically when they came out with another Siddur, and they revised the Siddur, this caused Isaac Bernays felt that the non-religious were breaking the status quo, and he called out against them. And this is where we pretty much ended last week. Last week the Siddur did have more additions than the first Siddur, and it also had more of the Reform ideology. Okay, so not only did they like remove things like Mashiach, but I guess more things like that's what they removed things that they didn't agree with, like ideas about Mashiach and things about getting back to the punishing the non-Jews for all the atrocities they did for us, and that's what they came out with a new Siddur. It was protested by Isaac Bernays, but this time, Isaac Bernays did not. I don't know if it was he didn't or, but the response from the Frum world, the Orthodox world, it was basically no response, with the exception of Rev Yaakov Ettlinger, who was a Rav of a nearby German city, who was a very good friend of Rabbi Bernays, but there was a concerted effort of the Reform minded rabbis that they did put out support for the Hamburg Seder and the Hamburg Temple. So now already you're beginning to see that it almost it seems that there's more togetherness or there's more strength in the Reform community than there was in the Orthodox community.
Mm-hmm.
Again, we're another 20 years down the road, and even though it was a status quo, overall the school systems, the yeshiva systems for in Germany was very wanting. It was very lacking. Most of the children growing up did not get a strong Jewish education. And that, you see, whenever that happens, bad things happen. You could just probably take a look at America too. Like up until the yeshiva system started getting strong, you know, in the turn of the century, the first wave of Jews coming in the 1880s, you know, many of them were lost. They had great shuls. They had the Orthodox shuls every block, but there was no yeshivas. Very, very few yeshivas up into the 1920s, and even still there were a few. It wasn't until after the Holocaust, in the 1940s and 50s, when the rest, the Sheiros HaPleita came here, did the yeshiva movement start, and now there's the, since then, slowly but surely the shift, the momentum is towards coming from. Okay, but that's the same thing here. From 1820, 1840s, most of these people were growing up without a strong Jewish education. You also had a lot of these rabbis that were also going to universities and had different ideas, and they were also more secular. And so we ended off with the Siddur. I just wanted to show you now this Siddur. After the Siddur, they came out with a book, a pamphlet, with all the Reform like-minded rabbis and what they said. So I wanted to show you from the introduction of the book that they put together. Pointer isn't pointing. Okay. Okay. I don't know if I have a pointer tonight. So, all right. So this is the introduction of a book that the Reform put out, and that had many tshuvos, many responses. I don't know if you can call them tshuvos from these Reform rabbis all over Germany. So the introduction of the book is, for us, the term synagogue does not mean the agglomeration of all the teachers of the synagogue, but the concrete understanding of Jewish teaching, whose progressive, that's a good word they like using, progressive nature can be proved, and which knows how to preserve the divine spirit of the Jewish religion through the course of the ages. The synagogue of the spirit follows principles different from those of a formal and fixed rabbinism, which happily forms only a small fraction of Judaism. At least that's the way they felt, that there's only a small amount of the firm rabbis. In such rabbis, we see a hierarchical authority which we reject as error. Hence, we must hold up to, I don't know what the next word is, obloquy, all these apostles of regression. That's what the rabbis are. Progress! That's our slogan. In Judaism, we distinguish between the kernel and the shell, matter and form, the lasting and the ephemeral, the eternal and the temporal manifestation. It's just so interesting how they viewed themselves. We're the future. We're forever. There, that's it. They're gone. You know, as a matter of fact, there's nobody from these people. Their children, grandchildren, they're all, there's nobody. You know, there's nobody who can say now they're a descendant from Geiger that's Jewish. Right, okay. There's a lot of right. This distinction of the spirit of the synagogue, which disputes ceremonial law with Hillel, they don't agree with Halacha, but agrees with him that the whole law rests on one essential point, I guess. You know, this is referring to Hillel when somebody came to him and said, convert, I'll become Jewish if you can teach me the Torah on one foot. Right, so Hillel responded, you know, what you do, what you don't like done to yourself, don't do to your friend. Matasani, last but don't do to your friend, and that's it. That's the whole Torah. But the last three words, now he said, now go study. they leave that part out. Now go study it. So he says, that we agree with. We don't agree with anything halachic of Hillel, but you know, Israel needs more such teachers and more of them to appear. For our time provides a natural school for such men, and in them we see the possibility and hope of a complete Jewish regeneration. But you men of regression, you who are kept in the bonds by the spirit of the dark ages, you who misjudge the rights of the present, and who can see in us nothing but frivolous iconoclasts, in vain do you battle against the necessity of change in religious life. Learn wisdom from the sages. the chutzpah, using your learning against yourself. Learn wisdom from the sages of the former centuries, who paid attention to the heartbeat of the times. But if you reject organic change of ritual as heresy and apostasy, and declare its followers as non-Jews simply because they did not recognize all of the phrases of the old rite as obligatory prayers, and as before, you will further hasten the ruin of our father's religion and will force the supporters of change to abandon you altogether. It's like so interesting how they didn't get it, that the Torah is eternal, what Hashem said, and you have what you can argue with in the framework of Torah. But to say like it didn't happen, or you're equal to people before, you're not religious and you don't study it, and you think that you can know more than all these people that. But that's what they felt of themselves. Well, we're modern and we're better because we're more secular, and therefore we know more.
Leaving the state.
Every attempt to stand in the way of or even to suppress progress will be no more successful than Bilam's attempt to ban and curse, which turned into blessing. In the same way that the latest reaction against the temple became helpful rather than harmful, especially since the enlightened teachers in Israel had an opportunity to express themselves in favor of progress. So they're saying, well, everybody else did progress. No, everybody else, you know, within the framework of Torah and mitzvahs, they were able to, not change any of the mitzvahs, but they were able to, you change the dress, whatever was within the framework of halacha, they changed. We therefore offer these pages of rabbinic opinions, this is different like reform rabbis, to our contemporaries and posterity as a true movement of progress, and confidently look to the future of which it is written, but there shall be a covenant that I will make with the house of Israel after those days, says Hashem. I will put my Torah in their inward parts and write them in their hearts, for they shall all know me, from the least of them to the greatest of them. This is in Hamburg, 1842, Dr. M. Frankel, for the editorial board for the Temple Prayer Book. All right, introduction. Okay, this was the introduction to the book. Now, the only response came from a Rav Yaakov Ettinger. Try to play with it. I don't want to ruin. Oh, there got something. Okay, so Rav Yaakov Ettinger, to the distinguished, and this is what he wrote. And he says, to the distinguished communities which have been placed under the holy guardianship of my rabbi, the communities of Israel. Until now, I have restrained myself from becoming involved in the controversy surrounding the publication of the revised Siddur of the Temple Association of Hamburg, which is entitled Prayer Book for the Public and Private Worship of Israelites. See, one thing that the Reform wanted to do is they weren't just enough that we're doing this. They wanted everybody to follow their lead. It's not just good enough for me, Kol Yisrael Rebbe Zelizer, I guess that's the way they viewed it. Until now, the reason I've remained quiet was in order not to add fuel to the fire, which would result from my participation. I decided rather to remain silent for the sake of peace and harmony. My heart is constantly aching at the sight of those amongst the frail and scattered Jewish people who don't muster the courage to assert themselves among the nations and live according to their holy faith, but rather live such a life that threatens this faith, as it has become increasingly apparent in our own times. I had in mind to preclude the danger that would come about through becoming involved in this terrible controversy, as it would only bring about harm to all those involved, and I hoped that the conflict that erupted in the neighboring community of Hamburg would somehow resolve itself without outside intervention, and a peaceful solution would be found to the satisfaction of all parties. After all, many years have passed since the creation of the Temple Association, right? It was about 20 some odd years, and nothing had really changed to alter the situation. Not even the name Siddur, prayer book for the public and private worship of Israelites, whose goal is obviously to spread their false doctrine, false is in parentheses, moved me to cry out and raise my voice in protest against this attempt to blind the community. Because for the last 20 some years, the Temple Association stood apart from the mainstream community, and its conspicuously perverse ways were sufficient reason not to fear that their doctrine would spread amongst you, my dear communities. However, a certain group amongst them whose purpose is to confound and annul the present institutions, I call them the Party of Aggression, brought together the opinions of outside rabbis, and hence they took a limited and local controversy and turned it into a fundamental controversy that ensnares into its grip those who would otherwise desire peace. They even took a further step and claimed that my silence was actually an approbation to the sitter and to the ideas that are contained therein. I have therefore taken the step of engaging in this controversy for fear that you, the precious keepers of the faith, might be affected by these ideas, and your spiritual leader, and out of my love of truth, I am making the following statement. So again, I guess he heard, well, Rabbi Ettlinger is not saying anything, he must agree with us. So, and that forced his hand. 23 years ago, the Temple Association produced their first prayer book, and virtually all the authoritative rabbis of Europe expressed a united opinion that it was not permitted to utter the holy prayers in any other language except the holy tongue, Hebrew. I guess the book was still there, and everything they said was still true. So it's like almost maybe trying to figure out why they didn't redo this book, because maybe everything, what's there more to add? How can we add anything more to the Chassam Sofer and Rabbi Akiva Eiger? There may be some response, you know. Again, who knows if the response would have made a difference anyway. But and in addition, that no Jew has the right to change the present form of prayer, which has been established for many hundreds of years. These two principles are not realized in this prayer book of theirs, even in regards to the most important of the prayers. Furthermore, the principle of our faith regarded Mashiach and the redemption take on a completely different meaning. In this Siddur, from that which has been understood by all of Israel throughout the diaspora for well over 2,000 years, as they don't want Mashiach to come. For that reason, their siddur is permeated with the spirit of heresy, and is forbidden for any Jew to fulfill his responsibilities of praying through the guidance of the siddur. Since the siddur is now coming out in a revised version, and it is invalid and forbidden for any believing Jew to pray from it, and its distribution is poised to increase, it is appropriate now to mention the prohibition of the great rabbis. I agree with their position with all my heart, and I'm certain that all the true rabbis of our period, with the exception of some marginal ones, would agree with those great authorities. It is therefore forbidden for any Jew to pray from this siddur. Esteemed congregations, take heed to these words and beseech Hashem, the God of our forefathers, who has guided us up until now in peace, that he turn the hearts of our wayward brethren towards the good, so that they not destroy, but rather build and support the structure of our holy and ancient faith, and seek out their true mission in this world and their portion in the next world together with all of us. And this is Altona, Wednesday, 8th of December, first day of Chanukah, 1841, Yaakov Aaron Ettlinger, Chief Rabbi of Altona. Okay, that was the response. Okay, so after this, I wanted to focus on, as I said before, Avram Geiger. And Avram Geiger is going to be another one of these leaders that's going to make himself involved in promoting the Reform Judaism. Avram Geiger, 1810 to 1874, was a German rabbi and a scholar who led the foundation of Reform Judaism. I guess scholars reform. Disillusioned with Jewish tradition, he emphasized that Judaism is an evolving and changing religion, and sought to remove its nationalistic elements, particularly the doctrine of the Jews as the chosen people. We're not chosen, and it's changing, and everything is basically just like the Christian religion is changing, so we ours is also, yeah.
When they use the word scholar, does that imply always...
I'm not sure where I got this from. I could have gotten it from there, from a Yeah, I mean,
universal.
Right, universal scholar, and he went to many universities. He has degrees, and he made doctorates. Tiger was a gifted child who began in his early intellectual career to question the assumptions of traditional Judaism. He attended Heidelberg and Bonn, and he served in the synagogue of Wiesbaden. Okay, and then eventually became Chief Rabbi of Breslau. Chief Rabbi of Breslau, that's where this big controversy is going to take place. This is Germany. So this is Heidelberg and Bonn, these are the two universities. Wiesbaden, this is, I guess you know where Hamburg and Berlin are. These are the two, this is where Hamburg is the where the synagogue was with the shul, the temple. And Berlin, this is where the temple where Jacobson had moved. And Berlin also happened to have been the capital of Berlin. Happened to have been the capital of Germany. And we're going to see Breslau is a little over to the west. This over here is going to be Poland. And we're going to see Breslau is going to be in western Poland. Okay? So Geiger, he goes to school, doesn't like school. His father, who's a Rav, teaches him till his bar mitzvah. Shortly after Geiger's bar mitzvah, his father passes away. And his brothers, his older brothers, seem to support him, send him to university. At 17, he writes his first work, an analysis of the Mishnah. Okay, as compared to, he also works on a grammar and glossary. I guess he was a writer. He was a prodigy. Okay, and besides his family, he decided in 1829 enter the University of Heidelberg. And where he was there for one semester and he studied Syriac. I guess, what is that, like an Arabic type of a language? You know, okay. And then next winter he went to Bonn to study Arabic. Okay, so he's a linguist. He's a, you know. There he met and befriended in Bonn Shamshul Foel Hirsch, which we'll may get to next week. His subsequent colleague and later opponent. His new circle of friends, however, here is where he met a society of these maskilim going to these universities did not help him with his understanding of true traditional Judaism, but it made it a, that's it, like his new, the new ideas, the new secular ideas. Okay, but no, he doesn't, he first goes to a synagogue in Hanau, east of Frankfurt, but he did not get that post. And then, but in the meantime, he makes an essay, because he's learning Arabic, so he writes a prize-winning essay on the Jewish elements of the Quran, which he later published in German. In this work, Geiger sought to demonstrate Judaism's central influence on both Christianity and Islam. Yeah, we're all one religion. You know, we're all the same, nothing different. Arguing both religions serve to transmit the Jewish monotheistic belief to the pagan world. On November 1832, okay, he became the rabbi of a community in Wiesbaden. Okay, this is again 24 miles from Frankfurt. Soon after he became engaged, he didn't marry her for 7 years. Okay, so we saw where Wiesbaden was. Wiesbaden is Frankfurt, and right below there is Wiesbaden. So he was here for a short amount of time. During when he's here, he's gonna hold one of these synods for rabbis. He's going to, just get back to where, okay. What he's going to do here is he's going to make a conference of German rabbi, of Reform rabbis. Now, that first conference doesn't really accomplish too much, but it starts the structure of all these rabbis. Instead of you having a Reform rabbi here or here or here, so now they're like going to be connected to each other. And they have who to talk to and borrow ideas from them. And one of the things that Geiger holds is that you can't make changes without Besdin or without the Jewish community agreeing. So now I'm getting all these rabbis together, and that's the Jewish community. Now we can make the changes. Yeah.
But he's coming from a Frum house or not?
Yes.
100%?
Frum house, yeah. From. And that's it. They all came, the originals all came from houses.
So you have to get a real Jewish education.
Yeah, sure. Isaac Jacobson also. I'm sorry, Israel Jacobson also. All these leaders, they all came from, because that's all that they knew. And they were given a secular education, and then they went off. They had their ideas.
Shifted their perspectives.
Right. Okay, when he was in Wiesbaden, he already was, you know, with the davening. I mean, he already had the idea of Israel Jacobson's, you know, changing the sitter a little bit, leaving things out. See, he already in his shul, in his, he already started changing the prayers. And that's, he's going to bring in 1837, and that's going to be the start of something. He started this idea of these rabbis getting together, and it's going to be very, for pushing reform, it's going to be very, very effective. Very, very effective. Okay. He didn't stay there for too long. It probably was too small of a shul. He didn't feel he was being effective enough. So now it comes to Breslau. Now Breslau, it was a major, major city. And there was, I think the assistant rabbi position became available. And they were interviewing different people. And he came and gave a speech. So the board were very secular, who was, you know, and he gave a speech 5 days later. They loved his speech. He like blew him away. 5 days later, they offered him the job. Now, he's not religious. I mean, not religious. He's an apikoros. He doesn't believe in the divine right of Torah and everything. He believes it's changing. You can do whatever you want with it. And, so what do you do? So there was this Rav.
Was this a Rav Rav's shul?
Yeah. Rav Tikhtin was a very chash of a Rav. He was there for a long time. And now the shul just hired a Reform rabbi. So could you picture, like, you know, a Shari Tula, the assistant rabbi that's appointed, is a Reform rabbi. So what do you do?
Was he showing, like, his true colors?
Oh, right away. Right away.
So
right.
He wasn't hired yet.
He wasn't hired.
And they still elected him.
Well, the board that elected him were very secular. Oh. You know, it was a secular board. And I guess they were looking for somebody. Rav Tikhtin was old school, you know, and he was like real traditional and everything. And now they were looking for something new. Now, they were looking for a Rav Barnes, you know, like had they gotten a Rav Barnes, that would have done it.
So this board had no yeshiva.
Most likely, right. They're very secular. They're living in a secular world. I don't know how strong of a secular Jewish education they had.
I can see that speech.
Yeah, you know, it was.
It got him elected.
It got him elected 5 days later. Right. They didn't even bother waiting for anybody else. They said, so now what Rav Tikhtin did is he's like realizing this is not worse than bad. This is. So the first thing he did is. He tried, in order for him to move to Breslau, he needed papers, he needed a passport, so that's it. So they said, don't let him become a citizen here. Again, this is in Poland as opposed to Germany. So it's a different country, so to speak. So his first thing was a delaying tactic, which worked for about a year and a half. And basically what he did is he tried to get the government and say, look, you know, 20 years earlier, you didn't want any changes from these radicals. You didn't want a new Judaism to come up because that would lead to a new Christianity. But and therefore, this is it. He's the same guy. He's the same, you know, same circle. This is the same mold. But this time, 20 years later, they weren't interested. They weren't. Basically, afterwards, they after a year and a half of pushing it off, they gave him his citizen papers and he came. Just to show you, he finally is installed. They only can push it off that much. This is where it's now, I don't even know how to say this word, but Breslau is called Brocklaw, maybe it is. Maybe he's read it, Breslau also.
I think W is a B there.
Huh? Okay, so Breslau is now Rocklaw. That's what it's called now. You see how weird it is? It's somewhat near Germany. Where the Y is in Germany, that's probably where around Berlin is. So it's been in places not so far, but it's now part of Poland. It's part of Western Poland. most of the most of the yeshivas, you know, were his Lithuania, so it is still quite a distance from Lithuania, and eastern Poland is where a lot of the yeshivas are as well, and Hasidism is in Belarus and Russia, you know, that's where they are too, and also eastern Poland as well. So, okay. The next, okay. So then, basically, they try to get the government, like, we don't want him, we don't want changes, you don't want changes, but that's it. They weren't able to stop that as well. They actually spoke to him, and when the government, whoever was in charge of the religion in the government that made these decisions, they spoke to Geiger. Geiger gave such a great answer. They said, okay, fine, your election is valid and it's fine. They agreed, granted him his naturalization papers, and that's it. He was inaugurated. And finally, now he's in Berlin. Okay.
Breslau.
I'm sorry, Breslau. Now, part of his inaugural address. Now he's speaking as as the assistant rabbi. And this is what he said, January 4th, 1840. Judaism is not a finished tale. There is much in it form that must be changed or abolished. It can be assumed a better and higher position in the world only if it will rejuvenate itself. All should unite in this work. So, like, okay, this is his opening. He's not hiding anything. He feels that this is what should be done. And he has a lot of people that like these ideas. They're secular. I don't know how religious they are, but they want, you know, to change the religion to make it more palatable for them. Now, one of the things Tikhon does is he closes everything down. So officially, Geiger is on like the Beis Din, right? So if, you know, there would be a Beis Din, so Tikhon, Rev Tikhon, and Rev Geiger would be on the same Beis Din. So he refused, Tikhon refused to be a part of anything that Geiger was there. He like ignored him. He didn't, but he wouldn't do. So if anybody needed a Beis Din for the next year and a half, they had to go to a different town, because he didn't call the Beis Din. He wouldn't call it out. He wouldn't officiate at anything that Geiger was there. It did happen. It did happen at one time. There was this funeral, and basically it started. Rav Tikhon was the first speaker. And as he gave his speech, he also said non-complimentary things about Geiger, who was also there. And then Geiger got up to speak, and the supporters of Tikhon shouted him down, whereas the supporters of Geiger's, you know, got involved too, and they had to call the police. It was it got very, just beyond words. As a result of that, they fired Tikhon. They got rid of Tikhon, but I think the government forced the. How'd they get rid of him? On the technicality that he didn't give his speeches in German. So the government, they say, oh, yeah, there's a law in the books, you have to give your speeches in German, and that's it, you're fired.
Was that Poland?
Yeah, I think it was still under Prussia at the time. There was no more Poland at that time. Poland didn't exist. In 1790s, it was taken over by Prussia, Austria, and Russia. So this was part of the Prussian Empire at the time, and the law on the books was you had to speak in German. So when the government heard about this, they said, that's ridiculous. The government said, you could be the rabbi. So he was the rabbi. So the people in the congregation, the people in the community, in Breslau, they wanted the peace. So the one idea they had was that the Rav would do all the legal halachic things, and Geiger would be the preacher. Okay, but Geiger said, "No way. He doesn't want to just be a preacher. He's looking to make changes. He needs to. He wants to be the big Rav." Yeah. So in any case, it just. And as a result of this, again, There was a lot of support coming in for Geiger. There was also support coming in for Tipton. But again, it created a tremendous controversy among them. Shortly after Tipton dies, I think he dies in 1842. Just see. Okay, Tipton. So again, Tipton went out, and many people supported Tipton, and these pamphlets both ways. So now you have polemics again on both sides. But Tipton died in 1843, which meant that Geiger now became the city's chief rabbi. So now you have the city's chief rabbi, who's totally not religious. Like, you know, he's totally reformed. What ended up happening is the religious element, I guess, there was still from people there. They weren't giving in on this. So they elected Rav Tikhton's son. What's the Rav Tikhton? This is, I think, I'm not sure, Rav Shlomo Tikhton, but his son was Gershon, Rav Gershon Tikhton. So they hired Rav Gershon Tikhton to be their Rav. And basically it was a big standoff, but the compromise that everybody made was as follows. Rav Geiger was the Rav of the entire community of Breslau, and Rav Tikhton, the son of Rav Tikhton, Rav Gershon Tikhton, was also the Rav of the entire city of Breslau. Okay, they I guess it was also, we're going to see that the Prussians and the Germans, they're not into splitting communities, splitting shuls. There's one community, there has to be one shul, and so they didn't like the ideas, you have a shul and I have a shul. No, you're one community, the Jewish community has to be one community. And we're going to see, Reb Shamsul Fuel Hirsch is going to fight this. And he felt it was going to be very important to be able to separate out from his community. But here, so they said, okay, this was the compromise. They're both full rabbis. And so those that wanted to be under the reform followed Geiger. And the others followed Tikhton. And that's pretty much how the status quo, the new status quo in that city continued. There was just one other thing that Geiger really did, and that we saw that before, is these synods. And in 1932, well, just the ending of Geiger, to the end of his life, he always wanted to teach, and he always wanted to make his own seminary. And the seminary that was there, he got a big supporter, but he wasn't appointed as the head of it. And then at the end of his life in Berlin, he became finally in 1870, he became the head of a seminary there to make reform rabbis. And that's it. That was his preaching there, his teaching, but he died 2 years later. And this is it. I think even today, this is where the building was. That's the building of the seminary, but he was only there for 2 years. I just wanted to just say the synods were very instrumental for, and there was a number of them. So the first one was 1837. It was Geiger's idea, it was his brainchild. Let's get all together. We realize we're not alone in our own islands, we're all together. So the first one really didn't accomplish anything except for the fact that we're all together, and they may have made some committees, and they may have made some like bylaws of the synod. So this is in order to make changes, this is what we're gonna do. It has to go through a committee, and what exactly is binding on the rabbis, what's not binding, you know, because every rabbi, how can you gonna force me to do this? My community's not gonna. So certain, and this was, they made a framework on how to pass laws or how to change things. That was 1837. The next one's about 7 years later, it was in Wiesbaden, because that's where he was, that's where Rabbi, that's where Abraham Geigel, he was the rabbi there. The next one is in Brunswick in 1844, also attended by 25 reform rabbis, including Geiger and Samuel Holdheim. He's another big their leaders. Again, no substantial resolutions were passed, and the conference was attacked by all sectors. The Orthodox protested against this. Also, there's a, we're going to get to him as well, Zacharia Frankel. Zacharia Frankel is the father of conservative Judaism. So he was there too, and once he, he wanted change, but not as much and not as fast as they were doing it, as the Reform was doing it, and therefore he left. He said, that's it, I'm out of here. And they, like, they were upset with him. Well, what are you leaving for? Just because you didn't get your way, we voted on this. You were in the minority. If you think you can, you're better or whatever, so convince us. That's the way they felt. Zacharia Frankel felt, these guys, they don't know what they're doing, and they're wrong, and they're too much and too extreme. Again, they were all, following the conference, 116 Orthodox rabbis declared that nobody could abrogate the least of the religious laws. This is in Brunswick in 44. Now, Frankfurt in 45, with 31 rabbis, and this time Frankel did come, and they led down, they started doing things. I'm sorry, in 1845, that's when Frankel was overruled, that's when he left. It was in this one, not the last one. And now they started dealing with things in the Siddur, they started dealing with Chalitza and various different laws. 1846 in Breslau, and again, this is where Geiger is. This is now under the Rabbi Tichton died, and now Geiger is the chief rabbi of Breslau, so they have the conference there. Even to the extent you see where they're holding Holbein suggested that Shabbos should be changed to Sunday. You know, but I think he was voted down on that one. The abolition of the second day Yontif. They started talking about circumcision, it's in a hygienic way. And now the laymen of the Reform laymen, they want in also on this. They demanded that laymen should participate in future meetings. In the next year or two, did I skip one? Okay. In 1868, 20 years later, 24 rabbis met in Kassel to prepare such a synod. To the sign of assembly at Leipzig. This is where the fairs were, and lots of good place to have a synod in 18. So they were preparing it for next year, which had 49 laymen, 34 rabbinical delegates from 60 communities. So this is where it was really, really, this was one of their biggest ones. It dealt with Jewish education, Siddur reform, and other questions. The Orthodox and Frankel sympathizers were not represented at all. And lastly, in 1872, 2 years later in Augsburg, there was another one which only had 30 communities. Resolutions dealt with marriage, chalitza, and other subjects, but the stand taken on Shabbos was more conservative than before. 133 rabbis published on protests. I guess the sign is the rabbis felt that what they were hoping to get out of it, they were not as successful, and this was the last of these rabbinic councils that got together. However, it just said that's it. It showed the strength of the Reform community, the rabbis. They're able to get together, they're able to deal with issues, and it would be like this in 1871, and it's just going to get stronger and stronger. By the early 1900s, I think, before the Holocaust, I think there was like about 90% assimilation among German Jewry. What basically Reform basically did is it took assimilation and it just slowed it down a bit. You know, so instead of these Jews assimilating right away and that's it, so they took a little, maybe, you know, longer. They were connected to Judaism that much more. But the end was, it did not keep the Jews within, and that's also, we know that without Jewish education, real Jewish education, without, you know, people's whims and ideas and emotions and feelings, that's not going to keep Jews what they are. What is Torah, Halacha, and real commitment. Okay. So, Mr. Hashem, next week, my plan is to go to the response to this which is Reb Shamshel Raphael Hirsch. Frankel, the conservative, or the conservative, the new, that once they're going two very far directions, there's room for the middle, right, you know.
So Frankel was the start of the conservative?
Right, right, conservative. Okay, thank you all very much.
Okay, ladies. So, those people from Hollywood,